We all hope to one day build a business or launch a product and sell it for millions. In the case of Alan Schaefer, that dream was within reach and took an unexpected turn.
We sold the company for $12.5 million, a million cash and $11.5 million in stock. But it was Rule 144, so I couldn't sell it for a year. So we get it at 18, it goes up to 27. I'm looking to buy the boat in the British Virgin Islands, you know, literally. And by the time it was all said and done, Yahoo bought the company, bought Launch. And we had to surrender our shares at 92 cents a share. So my brother and I can tell you, we have the dubious honor of being able to teach people or show people how to turn eight figures into a roll of quarters.
Also on this week's episode, we discuss the art of exacting, get-tos and have-tos, and that words matter. And now, episode 12 of Culturation.
Good evening, my fellow citizens.
Are you ready? The main event of the evening.
The ideas.
It's the word that you put in.
The ability.
Can you dig it?
The talent.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
Those who influence, the entertainer, the business leader, and the entrepreneur, they're all right here on Culturation. And now, your host, Justin Epstein.
Welcome to Culturation. I'm your host, Justin Epstein. On this week's episode, we have the conscious collaborator, Alan Schaefer. Alan is an accomplished speaker, songwriter, recording artist, consultant, entrepreneur, author, and the CEO founder of Atlanta-based consulting firm Banding People Together. Organizations such as Netflix, Verizon, Microsoft, ESPN, NASA, Hilton, Cisco, and SunTrust engage Banding to help create high-performance leaders, teams, and cultures. In addition to successfully building and selling an online media company, Alan has rocked the U.S. servicemen and women in 15 countries, including Iraq, as the frontman of the band Five Star Iris. Some of his honors include performing at the Pentagon, winning the United Kingdom Songwriting Competition, being awarded Marriott's Bill Teufel Award, and performing the national anthem on national television. Alan earned a BS in communications from Florida International University. With that being said, I would like to welcome my good friend, Alan Schaefer, to the show today. Alan, thanks for coming on, man. Really appreciate it.
Humbled and flattered and excited, man.
No, man, I've been looking forward to this one. I know it's long overdue. So
me too.
For people that don't know you, I want to get a little familiar, just kind of give them a quick little overview breakdown on who you are.
Oh, man, that's a big question.
I know it's a big one, yeah.
So I am an artist, songwriter, consultant, soon to be author, husband, father of a furry animal, Rocco, student of awareness and believer in oneness.
Man, I need to step up my my resume to keep up with this. Gosh,
I don't know about that, man. Depends on it depends on who you ask.
All right, cool. So I want to kind of take people over the next hour or so through your journey.
Sure.
A little bit about you, kind of, you know, where you started, where you're at, so on and so forth. So I guess kind of where you were born, where you grew up, all that good stuff.
Sure. I grew up in Jacksonville, Florida.
Okay.
Born and raised, Wolfson High School. Just went to my 30-year reunion. You never think it's going to happen to you.
Jacksonville is like a nice area now. It's crazy. It's blown up.
It has blown up, and we didn't have stuff like NFL teams and Super Bowls when I was there. Like, I had to get out if I wanted to do music. So I grew up in Jacksonville. I went to University of Georgia, and because my twin brother was going to Georgia Tech. And after a couple of years, 3 football seasons, I decided that I wanted to be the next Bill Marriott.
Okay.
And so I transferred to Florida International University because they had this really great hospitality management program. Transferred in January when it was warm. It was awesome. And then I was down there studying hotel restaurant management, and I had this kind of life-altering experience. I got sick.
Okay.
And I started getting these crazy headaches, and I would pass out when I stood up, and it was pretty nuts. And so a friend of mine, actually a friend of my family, said, we need to check into this. And I went to the lab, and they drew my blood, and they called my parents and said, you better get your kid to a doctor ASAP. Next thing I know, I had to drop out of school.
Wow.
And I went up to Jacksonville, and I spent a month at the Mayo Clinic.
One of the acclaimed medical facilities in the country.
Yeah, I went to the Mayo Clinic, and it was so intense. I was 21 years old. And they go, okay, they had bad things going on. Like, everything that they said, it was like stomach cancer, and there was just a guy from Colorado, a football player who was diagnosed and died in 6 weeks, and like all bad stuff. My parents come to me. My mother says, you know, your father and I have been talking, and we're going to sell the house and take you around the world to see, so you can see everything that you want to see. God. And I'm like, whoa, 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 wait, where's the fight? Where's the effort? Like, you know, I'm not really ready. And so after a month of testing, I started getting better. My numbers started coming up. My hemoglobin, which is what transports oxygen in the blood, like the low end of normal is 14. Mine was like 5. They're wow. like, how are you standing up kind of thing. And so I'll never forget going into the Mayo Clinic. My mother, my father didn't go because he was afraid of the result and the outcome. And the head of internal medicine says, okay, I got good news and bad news. I'm like, man, hit me with the good news.
Yeah, start
please.
With something nice first.
He's like, well, we can rule out all the life-threatening stuff. And I'm like, okay, well, what's the bad news? I said, well, the bad news is we have no idea what it was, but you're young, your body healed itself. We're just going to call it a miracle of youth. Have a great life. And that was that.
And you never found out?
Nope. And so I went back to FIU. I changed my major. I grew my hair down to my ass. I got my first band at 21. And that was that. And then that kind of put me on the path. And so when I graduated, I got a degree in public relations.
Okay.
And a minor in music.
Nice.
And so when I got to... when I took my last final, I didn't even stick around for the graduation. Like, I was ready for life to get happening.
Yeah.
Like, school was just an inconvenience. Like, I love to learn, but school was a pain.
Yeah, after a life-threatening, you think you're not going to make it, you're ready to go.
Yeah, and so I called up my twin brother, Robert, who was at Georgia Tech, and he was kind of moving towards the PhD program in electrical engineering. And I said, hey, man, I had my car packed up. Like, I wasn't even sticking around. Like, I'm taking my final, and I'm gone. And I was going to Jacksonville, and then I was going to either go to Atlanta or Los Angeles. I said to my brother, hey, man, I want to rock. And if you want to rock with me, I'll move to Atlanta. And if you don't, I'm moving to L.A. He goes, well, come rock with me. So I moved to Atlanta. I had my new degree. I had to find a place where I could get a job where I didn't have to cut my hair. So I'm calling all these places, and I call a record company, Warner Electric Atlantic. And I go, are you guys hiring? And they're like, sure, in the warehouse. So I worked for $6 an hour with my new degree in PR. And then I got out of the warehouse. There was one job working for all the radio promotion people.
Mm-hmm.
And I got that job. And I was like, if I get that job, I'm hanging. If I don't, I'll go back to music school.
Okay.
And I got that job. And that's really what kind of put me into the music business. And I did radio promotion first for Warner Electra Atlantic and then specifically for Electra. And, you know, I was the guy that bought tickets. I did the ticket buy, so I had lots of friends. You know?
everybody send you out.
And like I was using that to like run the band empire. Like, you know, there were promoters that were like giving us good opening slots because I was getting a Metallica ticket.
There you go. Yeah.
And so I did that, and I was on this path to maybe get my own territory with Elektra.
Mm-hmm.
And then my twin brother came to me and said, hey, man, I've been working at the GTRI, which is Georgia Tech Research Institute, and we do research on this thing called the World Wide Web. And I'm like, what is that? Well, they got these things. They're called websites.
Yeah.
What the hell's that? Well, it's this, you can find information. And I've been looking for information on concerts, and I can't find it. So I want to build one of these websites, and I want to call it tourdates.com. And I said, dude, you get the name I'm in, you get the name I'm out. Comes to me, he goes, I got the name. Quit my job at Elektra. Took $30,000 equity line, a credit out of my parents' house under the, hey, these aren't the drawers you're looking for, pain in the chest, and went to South by Southwest. We had a little demo.
Yeah.
And the whole thing was we wanted to create a platform for bands like us that, like, everyone knew about the big bands coming, but no one knew about the small bands, so we wanted to give them a voice.
So now let me ask you a question. When you guys were growing up, were you and your twin brother into music?
Yeah. So I've been playing since I was six.
Six?
Yeah.
How'd you get into music?
Well, everyone in my family played piano.
Okay.
So I played piano for about 2 months, and part of my proving against the grain mechanism, I'm like, screw this, I want to play guitar.
Okay.
And I started playing guitar, and I took jazz lessons, and I never really played in real bands, but like I was in high school jazz band and whatnot. And what's crazy is like once I went off to college, I kind of stopped.
Really?
But it was, I was 13 years old. My brother took me to see The Who. It was a bar mitzvah present.
That's a heck of a bar mitzvah present.
He drove up from University of Miami to Jacksonville, picked up his two little brothers. In the Citrus Bowl in Orlando, the B-52s and Joan Jett opened, and I'm looking around, and I go, I want this. I want to do this, man.
That was like your aha moment?
Yeah, so then I was like trying to become a great guitar player, and then you know, I went to New York where my brother graduated and moved to New York. And so like a year later, I bought my first electric guitar at Sam Ash. I saw this unknown guitar player that no one had ever heard of named Stevie Ray Vaughan. Yeah. And I sat this close to watching a guy named Les Paul.
Wow.
And met Jeff Beck. And I was like, oh, this is meant to be. I'm on the path. So I was doing the music thing all through school. But then once I got to college, I just went, even though I was in Athens and the music mecca and all this, I'm like, no, man, I want to build a hotel brand. So I just went, dong, gone.
So you just completely exited the music space at that point.
Yeah, completely. Which is interesting. So, and this is one of the things I, you know, it's bizarre and I've never thought any differently, but I've never had a day in my life where I had to figure out what was next. I just went, well, okay. It doesn't matter that I did all that or that I attached that I'm going to do this, this, and this. I'm like, nope, this is what I want to do now. So I'm pivoting.
So do you think that you were able to, like you said, not have to figure it out because you had a clear vision in your head? Do you think it's because you just figured out it will work out? What was kind of your tool or secret there? Because as a lot of people will say, they don't typically have that type of situation. A lot of times they get lost or they try to figure out the next move or the pivot's not as fluid or as easy.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I don't think I really – I think when you're young and you have your whole life ahead of you, you're not really thinking about – strategy or smarter or hard. you're just going for it. Like, hey, I want to do this, and I want to do this enough to where it's like banging on my head and my heart in a way that I can't ignore it, so I'm gonna pursue it.
Yeah.
And I was really lucky. Like, I never had a family, or my parents never said, well, no, you can't be a rock star, or, no, you can't do this. I was like, okay, sure. You're picking up and moving from Georgia to FIU, sure, okay, whatever.
How key do you think the support was from your family for the successes?
Huge. I will tell you, for any of you parents listening, let your kids have a shot. It will save them hundreds of thousands in therapy down the road. Because we all have to overcome our parents. And I love my parents.
No matter what age, yeah.
Yeah. You know, one of my greatest things in awareness that ever shifted for me was at one point years ago, I sat down and I went, well, I've inherited a bunch of assets from mom and dad and a bunch of liabilities. And I literally wrote them out on paper. And I went, holy crap, I've got to overcome this, this, and this. Or, man, am I going to be swimming uphill the rest of days? But, man, this stuff that I got from them is money.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a weird exercise. I don't know what made me think of it, but it changed my entire understanding of human behavior.
You know, from... for example, what you just said there, right, to where you are today and what you're currently doing, it seems like you've always been that type of person that's very exact, very specific on what's next? Because a lot of people don't break up lists like that.
Well, what's next was very exacting when I got to a point of believing it. Hey, this new shiny object, and holy cow, I believe it for all the reasons in my current psyche and belief system. Yeah, I'm going for it. Which, interestingly enough, I think also for any parents listening, you know, there's a lot of studies out there. If you look at little kids and kind of what they're drawn to and even how they play and how they, like, you know, look, the kid that wants all the toys to be in a certain order is probably going to be, you know, might be an engineer, and they might be the spreadsheet queen when they grow up.
Yeah.
Versus the person that's, you know, wanting to paint the walls with, you know, whatever when they're not supposed to. But incidentally, and I didn't realize this until about a year ago, in third grade, I won a countywide essay contest on brotherhood.
On brotherhood?
Yeah.
Okay.
And what struck me profound is, look, everything that I do, whether it's the music that I was making or the work that I do now with banding or how I interact with people in the world, it's all under the guise of oneness. And I believe we're all connected. And when I look back, that as a, you know, third grade kid.
Yeah, I was pretty conscious at third.
But you know, it's funny. And I actually have a picture of me and my dad in his 70s leisure suit and with the, you know, with the porn beard that he had, whatever he had going. And But it's like, you know, brotherhood is bringing a piece of birthday cake to your friend at school who couldn't make your party. I mean, it was like deep.
That's,
you know,
deep, man.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, so it's kind of, you know, so I think if you really pay attention to how kids are just being, it is an indicator. And so, look, I never had to go against the grain. I never had to rage against the machine because there was nothing to rage against. I didn't have anyone telling me, oh yeah, Alan, I know you want to be a rock star, but don't you think you should really do this? I never had that. So I was definitely one of the lucky ones.
Gotcha. So when you were taking, as most people would call, a chance or a risk, that's not a word you even associated with these things. It was just the next move.
Yeah, it was the next move. And here's the thing. I never realized it until the past few years, but I never really worried much about whether I would succeed or not. I mean, worry is betting against yourself.
It's a pretty good line.
Like, who the hell want, like, how many people do you know? They're like, yeah, I'm betting against myself. Like, why would you do that? And I don't even think that's anything special or profound. I'm like, worry is betting against yourself, and worry is this illusion that you cast because you have hyper-focused on an outcome that becomes crazy for you when it's not going the way you think it should be going, as opposed to the way the universe and the world is going to allow it.
Wow. Okay. I dig it. That's deep.
Dig it.
Sometimes the simplest things are the most profound things, though.
Oh, man. You know, that's the question is... Are things that are genius, are they genius because they're simple, or is it something simple that is genius? I don't know. And I'm not equating that word with anything I say or do, but, like, you know what I mean?
It's a good,
like,
way to look at it, though, yeah.
Yeah, simplicity.
So you are growing up, music is a part of your life, you're writing, you're super deep thought, like, you're structured, you have all these good assets and kind of like skill sets that you're kind of harnessing at a very young age, right? And
ish.
You're going to see them start to kind of evolve and grow, obviously, as you get older. So you go to college, you know, like you said, you get sick, you have this near death or don't know what's kind of going on experience. Was that kind of like an eye opener? How big was that and kind of you kind of figuring out, like, okay, I'm willing to do whatever it takes. Time is limited. Life is short. Like, what was the thought process?
Man, thank you for bringing awareness to that. So, you know, what's interesting is when something like that happens, man, if it doesn't get your attention, then I don't even know what to say. You know, so ultimately for me, I was like, when I was waiting to get that kind of final diagnosis or verdict from the Mayo Clinic, I made a deal with the universe. I was like, look, if I get through this, I'm going to do exactly what I want to do with my life. And that's why I went back and, I mean, Marriott was about to start paying for my school. Like, I was on that track. I was on the fast track program. I'm like, no, man, I got away from what I wanted to do before, really wanted to do. So I'm getting back to that. And so, you know, what's funny is I had to be pushed and I didn't think I was ready to be in a band. I was taking guitar lessons from this guy named Tommy Lee Strider. One day, his phone rings during our lesson. He answers the phone during the lesson, and he goes, yeah. He goes, yeah. He covers up. He goes, hey, man, you want to be a band? I'm like, no, I'm not good enough. I'm not ready. He goes, yeah, I got a guy right here. His name's Alan Schaefer. And I'm like, dude, what did you do? He's like, yeah, go audition. And that was it. And I was in a band called Vesper Sparrow. And, you know, kind of I learned a lot. I learned a lot about what to do, and more importantly, a lot of things not to do.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, when I came to Atlanta to rock with Robert.
Yeah.
Boy, that sounds like an album title. Rocking with Robert, or a kid's album. You know, I wasn't a singer, and we had another singer, and we had let him go. And I was like, okay, well, gosh, someone needs to sing. So I actually... called up someone named Jan Smith.
Great vocal coach.
Oh my gosh.
Great vocal coach.
Mama Jan. Yeah. I mean, like, the third show I ever did after like a few lessons, I was playing a sold out Roxy with my band Ground Score opening for the Radiators. And I was just like, man, and if you listen to the tape, if you could find it, man, I sucked. I mean, there's no question. I had fun. And in the moment, I thought I was great, but I sucked. Because the tape don't lie.
Yeah.
And so, but that's been part of my pattern also, which is lack of resources. I got to figure out what I need. And that, I thought that served me really well. But over time, and it did, like, hey, I became a pretty good singer. I became a songwriter because I needed one. But over time, what I've realized in the level of focus and kind of success for men, bringing value to the world and having your ideas be something and what other people call success, people like me are also way over-ambitious about how much we can do. And it's kind of that cliched sort of, jack of all trades, master of none. I mean, I wasn't a master of anything, but I was so good at the things that I had to get good at that it masked that there was still a gap for what we needed to get to that next level.
Gotcha.
So,
but you know what it sounds like? So two things. One, you know, you talk about this experience when you got sick and that kind of opened up your mind like, okay, now I need to do everything and I'm going to do what I want. Why do you feel like most people have to have, like, why can't we be predispositioned to already have that type of thought where every day matters, it can all be gone tomorrow? Why do we need those scary moments or those life-altering things? And then two, I think on top of that, you talk about the lead singer situation where you got called up to the plate, no training, and you had to get it done. Mm-hmm. How many times do you feel like people have that shot and they just instead, because of nerves or because they're scared or it's just too comfortable the way it is, they say, no, I'm good.
Yeah. So, you know what? And I've never thought about it in these terms, so I really appreciate you asking it this way. The reason why people have to have something like that, I think there's value in scarcity. I think that all of a sudden, you know, if I said to you, hey, man, after a day, you're never going to get to do another podcast. You'd have a very different idea, and you'd be a different type of present. Yeah. Not that you're not super present now, but I'm just saying, like, it would change. And so I think that anytime something feels like it's being taken away from us or going to be taken away from us, it makes us go, whoa, 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 wait, wait, wait.
Yeah.
You know, and that's really unsettling. It's unfortunate that it takes that, you know. I haven't figured out a hack for that yet.
That's the key. Yeah. If you could somehow figure that out, I would like to know.
Yeah.
Because I think it can motivate us in everything.
Yeah. I think it's probably not as easy as an app either. I don't think I can hack it with an app.
Yeah. And I don't know if an app's going to cut that.
Yeah.
So you do the show, right? You have the vocal training. You hear the tape. You're like, not that good now that you listen back. In the moment, you're loving it. So now what's kind of the next step in this journey?
I just tried really, really hard. Ground Score evolved into a band called Another Man Down.
Okay.
My ability to market and hype us was better, was probably exceeded the ability of the band as a...
It's a lot of people in the music industry, though.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, a lot of people are marketable.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean they're talented.
Yeah, a friend of mine, Andy Levine, who started, like the Rock Boat and all that stuff. Like, he actually, and I love him for it, he was really honest. And when I was starting the band Five Star Iris, I said, man, you got to come see the band. And he goes, I'd like to come. I want to come see the band when I'm hearing about you. That, like, you're just melting people's faces.
Yeah.
And he told me very honestly. He's like, he goes, please don't take this the wrong way, but I think your ability to kind of market the band exceeded the level of the band. And I'm like, yeah, that's fair. That's spot on. And so, I like to, stay under the radar and get something to a level to where then when the world or people start to find out about it, it's like, how in the world? Well, they haven't seen the 40 years it took to get there, or the 10 years or whatever. So Five Star Iris was really, that's where I had the most like success musically. Like I played in 17 countries, got to play for the troops in Iraq. I flew a plane. Like, I'm not going to say the branch, but a branch like let me fly a C-130.
By yourself?
I was in the left seat. I got to turn the plane. I mean, it was nuts.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah, I know. I didn't want to get anyone in trouble. but so we got to do this, and we got to do things like Plague the Fox and like all these great things, and we were on the radio, and, and we plateaued. Like, the band, we had all this talent and all this, everything was so cool, and we had fans and we had connections, and I was trying so hard, and, here's the thing that kind of, in between that, tourdates.com, we starved, and then in 2000, we were acquired by Launch Media.
Okay.
Which was, and that was like, wow, we just went from, oh my gosh, we're so broke we can't pay attention, to someone just paid 8 figures for our company.
That's crazy. And how old are you at this point?
30.
So at 30 years old, you get acquired for an 8-figure deal.
Yeah.
What's your first thought when that happens?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm sitting in Santa Monica in this office around this big table, and they're taking us around like it's a fraternity rush. Hey, it's the Schaefer brothers, aren't they cool? And blah blah blah. And then like after lunch, they bring in like the finance guys, and they're hammering our business plan. And I swear to you, this guy sitting next to me, and they're like, "We think this is aggressive. We think that's aggressive." Like I've just maxed out my last credit card to get here, and it's like you've asked me here, like, what's going on? My brother's sitting to my left. We have our two consultants across from the right. Another guy at the end of the table. And literally I said the words, I was so pissed off and frustrated. Like, I can't believe this was a waste of time. Like, what's going on? I didn't realize it was probably a negotiating tactic. Yeah. And I'm like, well, look, you asked us here for a reason. So if you're feeling froggy, go ahead and jump already.
Yeah.
And there's a silence. Like, did that guy just say, go ahead and jump feeling froggy? And the guy looks at the end, gets a nod and goes, well, we're prepared to offer you. At first it was, you know, 11 million for you, and we wound up negotiating and coming back, and I'm sitting there trying to like keep it together. Like we get in the car.
Yeah.
We're calling, you know, our girlfriends and our parents, and we're like, holy crap, holy crap. And we went through that whole ebb and flow of a transaction, and, you know, it was pretty life changing. But then people started taking shots at us locally. It's like, wow, the Schaefer brothers made the best record their .com money can buy, and all this just jabbing.
Yeah.
And my twin brother, who was super mellow, passive, you know, said something so funny. He goes, "I never take a shot at you when you're number two." And I was like, "Where'd you get that game, dude?"
Yeah, it's a good point, though.
Yeah,
and you know.
Yeah, so I stayed on for a year to oversee the integration. That was just a mind-numbing exercise of frustration. They pretty much destroyed what took us 6 years to build. They destroyed in probably 6 months. And then when I got the email that said, hey, we no longer need you, it was like, okay. And I was like, now what? So I wanted to be the best songwriter I could be. Started going to Nashville, got taken under the wings of some producers and songwriters, and that's then when I started Five Star Iris. And so Five Star Iris is rocking and we're doing well, and then we plateaued. And I'm having problems with the band. I'm out in LA with a buddy of mine, Briggs Ferguson, who I've just reconnected with. I saw him in Los Angeles 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago. And he goes, I tell him about the band problems, and he goes, hey, there's a book you might want to read that might help. It was called Five Dysfunctions of a Team by Patrick Lencioni. And I read the book. And for anyone listening, it's a great book. It's a leadership fable, and this about the dysfunction of a senior executive team in Silicon Valley, and just all that. It's like a soap opera, yeah. Really compelling. And I'm reading the book, and I go, oh my gosh, we're screwed. And it's all them. It's all everyone else in the band. They're not as talented as me. They don't want it as badly. They're not all in like I am. Well, what I didn't realize was it wasn't them. It was actually me. And so that was a bitter pill to swallow. And that's kind of what led me to trying to understand, why do some bands make it and why do other bands not? And that led me to leadership, team theory, complexity, behavioral diagnostics, organizational development, you know, all psychology.
Yeah.
And so essentially that's how banding people together was birthed. You know, what I would tell you if you asked me at a cocktail party is, you know, we help people step into their best selves when working with others. And we do, and I believe that. But it was born in trying to teach people not to be the asshole I was in the band. That's it. And so, like, as even though I was trying hard and making things happen,
yeah,
I'm the one that limited our upside. And so I got really passionate about teaching people not to be who I was.
How many people or how many times do you think problems amongst groups or teams is an individual that doesn't realize they're the one behind it like yourself?
Look, the problem is always the last to know.
It's a good way to look at it.
I mean, you know, and so ultimately, like what I do for a living and just even personally, when I help people try to get, hopefully, when I have the opportunities to help people get out of their own way in the same way that people help me get out of my own way, which, by the way, I still get in my own way. My wife will tell you, I have friends, a great friend and mentor, a guy named Dwayne Cummings, who was at LeaderCast. He really helped me. You know, we all have blind spots. And so once I got comfortable with, like, hey, I don't know what I don't know, I started flowing in a whole different way. And so, you know, just teaching people to see things differently and to see their part in it.
Yeah.
You know, we're not taught that anywhere along the way. So I do my best to that, you know, that's, those are the frequencies that get in the way of us coexisting in a way that creates oneness.
Gotcha. So now you are done with the music thing at this point, right?
Yep.
This is what, 2009, when you then have the idea for banding people together?
Oh, yeah. You mean, are you talking about the year that the economy tanked and that nobody in their right mind would start a frigging business?
That's the same year, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, that would be me. Yeah, I'm too dumb to quit. Yeah.
Too dumb or too smart?
I don't know. It depends on who you ask. You know, it's like on paper, that made no sense.
Yeah.
So I think also, you know, it's easy now, you know, 9 years later. At the time, first of all, I was like blinded by conviction and the excitement of building the idea. And that's, I think that's part of like the entrepreneurial spirit. And just look, we're all artists, we're all creators. And so, man, it's another thing to create. The fact that it was just at a time that made no sense. Oh, and my wife, you know, the real estate market, she was in real estate, that market tanked. So it's like, I mean, oh, and by the way, the part that I didn't share, and I'm an open book, I believe in radical transparency. You know, we sold the company for $12.5 million, it was $1 million cash and $11.5 million in stock. But it was Rule 144. So I couldn't sell it for a year. So we get it at 18, it goes up to 27. I'm looking to buy the boat in the British Virgin Islands, you know, literally. And by the time it was all said and done, Yahoo bought the company, bought Launch, and we had to surrender our shares at 92 cents a share. So my brother and I can tell you, we have the dubious honor of being able to teach people or show people how to turn eight figures into a roll of quarters. There's still people in Atlanta in the band scene that still think I'm like some millionaire guy that from that transaction. No, I got crushed.
So when that happened, a lot of people would let that defeat them, right? Or let that define them. Like when you look at numbers, people get so caught up on it, right? Mm-hmm. Hearing you just say it now, you've said it, it's just like, yep, it's what happened and
oh, yeah.
That's it. And now on to the next thing.
Yeah.
How do you mentally get to a state like that where, you know, you could just, at the time, was it as easy as you're making it seem now? Was it frustrating? Was it like, okay, time to get back to the grind? Like what was the mentality?
Well, for me, I was lucky. It wasn't, I mean, sure, I'd love to have the money, but at the time, I still made a lot of money,
yeah.
And it allowed me to be full-time band guy and to go all in on the band in a way that I was never able to do before. So again, it's like that thing stopped. I didn't have to go, what's next? I just lost millions. It's like, okay, I lost millions, but man, I have more money than I've ever had. And now this affords me to go like take the real stab, and that's going to lead me to whatever it's going to lead me to.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting because a lot of times people look at a piece of a pie, right? And let's say 20% of it, you got the money, right? You lost, let's say 80% or whatever the margin split is. Most people would focus on, I didn't get this. You look at it as, look at what I got.
Yeah.
And look at what it gave me. So you
abundance.
Focused on the positive versus looking at the negative and dwelling on that per se.
Yeah. Well, so thank you for giving me that much credit. But at the time, it wasn't even that I was focused on the positive. It's just like, I just felt like, wow, like all I wanted to do anyway was have a band and be a musician and get back to my thing from The Who in 1982. So yeah, man, like it sucks that I lost the money, but man, I'm way ahead and I get to do this on a level that maybe other people won't. And I can tell you, for me, I very passionately believe that had I not lost the money, I'd have never flown the plane and I would have never, I would have never gone to Australia with the Tampa Bay Buck cheerleaders, and I never would have been on the radio in Salt Lake City, and I would have never done any of that stuff. So, you know, it is what it is, and there is no good or bad. There just is. So if I had attached to the outcome of, like, no matter what, I'm going to be a bazillionaire at the end of this, I mean, I was hoping and thinking, but I wasn't so hyper-focused on that. I was more hyper-focused on, actually, once I was a millionaire, man, and I'd really get to play music the way I wanted. So I just had fewer resources, but way more than I ever imagined.
Wow. Okay. So then you start taking all these life experiences from music, from business, entrepreneurship, and then how does the, you know, I know banding kind of started going through your head at this point because of the fact of, you know, you were the one in the band that people were saying you were the problem. You realized yourself. where does the idea start to then really take shape? Because now it's grown into quite a company, but in the infancy state, kind of what was your, you know, kind of evaluation of like, this is what it's going to be? Well, and how much has it evolved, obviously?
Oh, man, it's totally evolved. And here's what's so funny. Like, I learned about this thing called corporate team building. And I'm like, oh, wow, they have, like, this experiential stuff. Hey, we're going to go build bikes, or I'm going to paint or cook or whatever. I'm like, oh, man, this is just another flavor. Probably a bit of an opportunist, you know? Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, man, I'll go into corporate America, teach people how to write songs, kumbaya, you know, whatever. Yeah. And I'll be another flavor. But again, very extra discretionary budget for that stuff in 2009.
Yeah.
Like, that stuff just disappeared. I didn't know any better. So I piloted at a nonprofit here in Atlanta called Families First, and did the first one. And then I didn't know what I was doing. Someone said, well, you can't just be band guys showing up into corporate America going, let's rock together. I'm like, I knew that. Someone said, well, you need an instructional designer. What's that? Well, someone who put it into a curriculum. Okay. I had to Google it, you know, and then, or search for it. And then I built out a curriculum, and, you know, we were doing the team building thing, but it wasn't really enough. Like, I'm like, I had this crazy vision. I wanted to measure collaboration on an individual team and organizational level. And so I found a PhD that wasn't too scared to work with a crazy band guy. And I was like, you know, Doc, I call him Doc. And I always say the same thing, Doc. Gotta keep me honest, man. I'm going to meet with a bunch of PhDs next week, and I can't get stuffed, you know. But I told him my vision, and he helped me build what became the Collaborative Harmony Index. And so, like, you know, there's Myers-Briggs, and there's all this, you know, you're an ENFP, your spirit animal is a wolf bunny, all that. Well, that stuff doesn't really stick. People can't remember it. It's not intuitive. It's a bunch of psychobabble. So I just basically created something that was like, well, if I had to sit through this stuff, what would I want it to be like? I want it to be cool. And I come from the world of music, so the opportunity was transferring the wisdom of arguably one of the most volatile, crazy environments, a band, on all these different ego-driven levels to other disciplines. So we did the diagnostics and built out this methodology, and now we were in the training business. And so now we were working with companies like ESPN and training leaders at SunTrust and all this, and that wasn't enough. Like, I didn't want to be like, man, it's a training company.
Yeah.
You know, and so we really evolved into a consultancy, which words matter, and I really didn't like, I didn't want to be called a consultant for a couple reasons. One is, you know, I think consultants are generally looked at as, oh yeah, you're going to come in, you're going to tell me what to do, you're going to ram the stuff down my throat. You're going to count on me not doing it. And that's just a way for you to bill more hours. So there's a lack of trust. Like, I want to teach people how to fish so they can eat forever, you know? But also, my identity was like, God, that's so not rock and roll. Like, consultant? Like, when I looked in the mirror, I saw a lot of things, but I didn't see consultant, you know, in a traditional sense. But I am a problem solver. And I help people help themselves solve problems.
Yeah.
And I help people create solutions that they believe in that will work. So, okay, so I'm a consultant. And so embracing that really helped us. And so ultimately what we've developed, and this is a funny time to be getting together because I've had this symphony in my head for 8 years of evolving, and my wife has been a gem. Big shout out to Teresa, a.k.a. Rita. Essentially, we've developed a human operating system.
Okay.
And it's a, which does exactly what we were talking about before. It helps people be their best selves when working with others. And so it's like implementing software into any system or in an organization. Like, but step one is there's this, we've created a language, like a language for being and coexisting and working that amplifies our differences and lets us show up authentically exactly who we are, but understand how we fit in the sound. Like, it's about a groove. Like, grooving for me is high performance. So ultimately, this operating system teaches the awareness that helps people, or that helps create alignment that enables what some would call high performance or execution, but in a way where, like, the process actually feels as good, if not better, than the result. And so I'm freaking out because, honestly, modestly, I like it works because we use it. It's a part of my life and who we are, and it's like there's a soul to it that I think organizations are missing.
You know, it's interesting because everything you're speaking of, you keep on using words like we and what we, it's how we versus I did this and I did that, which right out the gate already shows like mentally and kind of like how your predisposition, you're sitting there, everything is already team building to you, even from the way that you talk about yourself. It's not I ever.
Yeah. Can you appreciate how profound it is for my former bandmates relative to the business that I'm in? And I actually just spoke to one of them this past week, which was really cool. Dan, our drummer, had a part on Kevin Saves the World.
Yeah.
And we're like, holy crap, like unbelievable. And so he actually saw my picture on a thing for Seth Godin seminar. And he's like, I've been thinking about this. And then I saw your picture for the new thing. And I just wanted to reach out. So it's funny how that works.
So, you know, you start putting this together and now you're seeing it's like really working. It's really clicking.
Yes.
Now this is like, okay, you're starting to break it down and like really figure out a system here.
Oh yeah.
Right now. Oh, yeah. Now you're getting excited. How are brands and companies starting to hear about you at this point?
Everything's been word of mouth. And you know, what's interesting, and this is something that I learned from Seth Godin. I used to think in terms of titles and types of organizations. Well, this culture would be into what we're doing, or that. It's not about that. It's about a psychographic. And a psychographic is really different. It's not like, hey, here's a demo of, hey, here's the women 18 to 30, whatever. Psychographic is like, what's someone's belief system? You know? And so, like, all the people that hire us and hire us quickly, I can tell you who they are. They are lifelong learners. They're trailblazers. They're mavericks. They're not afraid to go against the grain if they passionately believe it's the best thing for everybody. They want to invest in people, not for a return, but because it's the right thing. They believe in what's possible. They're truly open-minded, and just because it hasn't been done before doesn't make a difference to them. And if I think about all the people who hired us very, very quickly, they're all that. And so I finally went, you know what? I've spent all this time in the past 8 years trying to drag people up a hill. It's not that I don't care about everybody else who doesn't get it, but I don't care. Yeah. It's not my job to rescue. It's not my job to convince an organization or a person that we can help. And so it's a frequency thing.
So now that you've kind of aligned with these folks, right? And I know alignment is a big word that you like to use. How many times now do you have brands that come to you where they're not somebody that you feel is the right fit and you say, appreciate it, but no, thank you?
I just told somebody on my team today that I'm saying no to a major, major RFP.
And without hesitation?
Without hesitation.
Would you have done that 5 years ago,
no.
2 years ago?
No. And I'm doing it, but I'm also doing it because I also, for the first time, now that I've actually finished this album in my head, and so we're going from repair and build and figure out to grow, I now have a strategy. And that opportunity, even though it's a big opportunity, it does not fit in that, in our, and how we get to X of growth. And so it takes discipline. And it's funny, the person on my team said, well, that takes courage. I'm like, I don't think it's courage. I think it's just like, that's going to derail me and us from the other stuff that we already believe is going to get us to whatever promised land we're heading to this year.
And you're not going to perform the best with these clients if you don't believe in what they're doing.
Oh, yeah. There's certain things also when we're like, I've gotten better vetting people and asking different questions. And actually, my buddy Dwayne that I mentioned really, really opened my eyes to that. You know, just something that somebody says, you know, people will say all kinds of things that they want. But a lot of people just, it's not that they're bad people. They're just not as willing to or capable for whatever reason to be as honest with themselves as they could be. Right?
Yeah.
And so it's like, well, someone will say, well, I mean, it's like someone who's trying to get clean. It's like, yeah. Or someone's trying to quit smoking. Yeah, I know I'm going to quit smoking. I need to quit smoking. But like, we all do what we desire to do. That's the one thing that I've learned. Like, I just watched a documentary on Netflix on John Coltrane. Man, that guy quit heroin cold turkey. Who does that?
Yeah.
He decided, so he did it.
You know, I think we were talking, I forget who I was with the other night, but we were at a dinner, right? And everybody's like, what's your New Year's resolution? And I find that to be such an interesting question.
Ooh, yes.
Because I sit there and say to myself, why do I need a new year on a calendar to say that now I'm going to do something different? Why can't I do it today? Can I do it yesterday? It's like if you need to reset or change who you are off of a date, I find that crazy.
Well, it is crazy. Well, we've been conditioned. That's part of the matrix, man. I mean, seriously, like the idea that you have, because you know, it's way easier to go, well, I'm going to do it then. And yeah. And I do these things, you know?
I mean, look,
hey, I'm
going to
do this so I can do this.
Look at gyms. The stats on fitness and health after the month of January.
Oh, yeah.
Spikes and then just goes down 80% probably.
Yeah, it's easy pickings, man. The fish jump in the boat. I think it's unfortunate. I think it's really unnecessary. And, you know, it's interesting. You know, it's not easy to get to a place of being honest with ourselves always, sometimes because of us, sometimes because of our spouse or external pressures of our family and whatnot. But I will tell you this, the one thing that I've found, you know, anybody that would look at what I do and go, wow, that he's figured out a few things. There's a couple things that I've figured out that have been so game changing for me that, is it okay if I share them?
I would love it.
So first of all, get to's and have to's. Like, that's my daily balance sheet, man. Like, if every day I wake up and I go, I've got way more get-tos and either zero or very few have-tos, I'm going to be happy. So, think about the people that you have in your life that's like, man, I have to go meet so-and-so. Like, I got to come here to hang out with you.
Yeah.
There's other people. There's someone out there right now, some famous person that's going, ugh, I have to go do another interview. And it's funny, I was on a plane, and this woman who was sitting next to me, I talk to everybody on planes, you know, I'm that guy.
Always fascinating, yeah. People on planes, yeah.
And I said, she goes, oh, what do you have next? Well, I have to go here, and I have to go here, and I have to go here, and I have to go here. And she goes, hey, if you don't mind, I'd love to give you something to think about. And I go, what's that? She goes, what if you didn't have to go anywhere? And what if you got to go places? And I went, oh, boom, mind blown. Yeah. So that really became a part of my psyche. And then the other piece is possibility over probability. Probability is like, I'm not saying don't think and don't reason and be smart, but probability makes us go, well, it's this or. My entire existence, the entire thing of banding, everything that is in my soul, in my world, is this and. Door number 3, door number 4, door number 5, door number 6. And they're almost always there, but we can't see past like our nose. And so that's the whole thing. People will tell you how open-minded they are, but those are people that are also missing out on stuff. It's crazy. But so possibility, like everyone thinks they're more open-minded than they really are.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a victim of it.
We all are.
You know, I always sit there. I feel open-minded. I always say, I'm listening to you. I'm hearing you. Which I do in a lot of cases, but at the same time, I also get defensive when it's things that I don't like or things that I can't have the answer to. So you get defensive versus being like, okay, let me think about it. Let me process it. Let me get back to you. We're so always trying to figure it out. I mean, I love the have to and got to scenario because if you ask most people, I guarantee you they feel like they have to do most of the stuff they're doing.
Yeah, that sucks.
And I think if you can get to the side where the have to's are limited, like you said, that's real wealth.
Yeah. So that's the thing. So we spend more time at work than we do with our families. So like imagine there's two people sitting in Atlanta traffic on the way to the office. One person, they both have their cup of coffee. One person's like, man, I have to go to the office. And there's another person that's going, I get to go here today.
Yeah.
And there's a whole number of reasons why someone would feel that way, you know, and we won't go super deep on that, but it really, it's like, it's pretty simple. Like, everybody wants to be heard, everybody wants to contribute, and everybody wants to feel like they're a part of something bigger than themselves, right?
So it kind of comes full circle for me with you a little bit, because we started off this interview where you talked about simplicity.
Yep.
And it seems like your key to success in life has been keeping it simple.
Yeah, so it is now.
Yeah.
I've had some great Yodas and some great mentors and some great teachers that would sit there, and when I would say, you don't understand, and they'd go, I hear you, Snowflake. You're special. You're unique. You're different. I'm like, no, but you don't understand. I'm like, simplicity. And, you know, my buddy Briggs would tell me, like, it's all about doing the right work. And when you're doing the right work, it is simple.
Yeah. I mean, it's literally like going back to when you're in third grade.
Yeah.
And what is brotherhood?
Yeah.
And it's really, this is what it is. It's bringing a piece of cake to a friend that doesn't have one. As kids, we simplify things. And as we get older, we overcomplicate them.
Yeah.
It's like almost tapping back into that mindset. So when you go into these companies now, and once again, like I said, you know, ESPN, Netflix, Verizon, Home Depot, I mean, the list is crazy. And once again, all word of mouth nonetheless, and they're investing into you. And these are companies that, like you said, they're leaders in their spaces, which is a real cool testament of kind of what you've been able to accomplish. What does the process look like when you go in to talk to these companies? Like, how does it start? What are some of the things you guys do? I don't want to give away all of it because obviously you got to pay for this.
No, sure.
But
so essentially what we do, so the process has changed because what would happen is, it's like, oh, you're the band guys. Come to our offsite, you know, come do our team building, come to, you know, and even as we were developing this really robust methodology, it's hard for someone's belief system to go, really, the band guys can transform our leaders or our culture? Like, man, he's a nice guy, but gosh, I can't, who's going to believe that?
Yeah.
You know? And so as we've developed more of a methodology, we've helped people make more of a space in their brain for something they haven't heard before. That's, you know, and so so the process is different. Now it's all the conversations I'm having now with current clients are, wow, you got a problem to solve. Okay. Yeah. I believe passionately we can help. And so here's how we implement the system. Step one is we get everyone in the team or the division or the organization speaking the language. And we do that through our experiential learning and diagnostics. Step two is put the tools and everything into practice and muscle memory, and that's through coaching. And step three is now you've got this great place, this amazing culture, this amazing like way of feeling and working and all that. You ought to protect it. So you have to think differently about your recruiting. Like, you got to interview differently. What you called a rock star yesterday might not even be good enough to warm the bench for you now. You know, I love it. Netflix has something like they don't tolerate brilliant jerks because they realize, you know, I'm like, God, that's so awesome. That's I wish I had line, thought of that, you know, in the band, I was the brilliant jerk. I wasn't brilliant, but I was definitely the jerk. And even in the beginning of the banding, I was still a little bit of the jerk and I've had to kind of overcome those patterns. And so the step three is like, how do you make this new way of working and being sustainable? So like, how do you assimilate a new person quickly? Because you got to teach them the language. It'd be like, hey, everyone here just learned Spanish and you just came up and you speak Greek. We got to get you speaking Spanish like in like a week.
Yeah.
Or a day or an hour. And so ultimately, the whole goal behind this whole thing, look, the great feeling of all that, that's just like the leftover part of the process, that's the candy. The reason for it is high performance. The reason for it is optimizing. Like literally, we create more time. And it sounds obnoxious. Like when I go and I do a talk and I'll stand up in front of a bunch of people and I go, okay, I get that this is going to sound crazy. I already know that you think I'm nuts because I'm the band guy up here. I have more time than I need. And I'll just sit there and I'll just watch people go, man, that dude's full of shit. You know, I literally have more time than I need because we're optimized. So a project cycle that should take take 6 weeks, we do in 4 weeks. A phone call that's an hour, our goal is to have it done in 40 minutes. How do we prepare so we have one meeting instead of six meetings? So it's all really about alignment, you know? And so ultimately in the system also, there's this five-step process to like, just look, if you're going to work together with people, there's a systematic, repeatable process that has to be. And here's the craziest thing. This is what keeps me up at night, that how the world isn't thinking this. We are expected in our families, in our churches, in our communities, in our workplaces to work together effectively in some way that is productive and matters. And it's insane. We've never been taught anywhere. It does not exist. We have never been taught. Like just that alone, people should be going, what the hell? Secondly, there's no agreed upon rules of the road. So like there's collaborative car crashes going on 24/7. Like think about, why does a car crash happen? People aren't paying attention. They don't know the rules. They blow off the rules. They don't understand the rules. So we're providing that GPS, right? That roadmap. And then the third part, which is nuts, what's collaborative to you, what's collaborative to me, might be two ends of the spectrum. So who's right? Now you're talking about subjectivity. And subjectivity is what causes irrational thinking and behavior. And that shows up in the form of, how did you not know that? I mean, crazy things that just sub-optimize us and make us spin. So in our thinking, if you're not aligned when you're working with someone, you're cooperating. You're not collaborating. And you know what happens when you cooperate? The meeting after the meeting. That's a time suck.
It's the truest. No, that is the truest shit ever right there.
Yeah. Who's got time for that? So here's the quan. You ready? The end game of all this is, I believe, and what we believe, everyone in our little band at Banding, it's funny, we consider ourselves a band because we also produce music in these sessions. So yeah. Like, we have a catalog of like they're better than they should be, you know? and so ultimately, if we can change it so that person driving in the morning goes, I get to come here today to work, that's going to show up differently when they come home at night. And when they walk in the door and their kids or their spouse says, how was your day? It's a different answer. Then you start changing families, that changes communities. And that's, to me, that's the path to oneness. And I'm not going to stop until I find the others and we find the others to help us do that.
So for you, it's not about so much investing into companies as much as the individuals that make up these companies.
Totally.
So community is key.
Absolutely. We're built for community. I mean, that's why, like, think about, like, when you go to a concert.
Yeah.
Like a Grateful Dead concert or whatever kind of concert. Like, there's this, or a U2 concert, there's a feeling of community. When you go, hey, man, I got a shout out to my Georgia Bulldogs. I mean, look, man, there's, like, that's part of the tribe. It's community. You know? And, like, we're wired to feel that. Workplaces, we're doing all this ill shit to make it so there's no chance for that. And so that's insane and that's criminal. And part of our job is to stamp out that insanity so people can be people.
So when you go into these companies and you do your work with them and you make your magic happen, how many of these companies are calling you afterwards saying, game changer?
So not to be so exacting, but we don't really make it happen. We create the conditions so it can happen. We have a part in it. We're like producers. Like, if you were an artist going in to make a record, like, we're not there to do it.
It's a great way to look at it as a producer, yeah.
Yeah, we're just helping form the Petri dish, so the magic. Like, how do you get the right people in the right room at the right time for the right reasons, solve the right problems, and feel great doing it? Like, that's the deal, right?
It's pretty cool.
That's really. And so, you know, it depends. Like, we're just now getting the opportunity, and we're launching some pretty cool case studies to where we're getting to go deeper and, like, really measure. But, you know, it's not hard to exceed expectations because the bar is so friggin' low, you know? And so it kind of goes into our underdog status. Like, we like to say, hey, we're the biggest band you never heard of.
Man, this is wild. So you have some new products coming out, right? What's next? What do you kind of have on the radar?
So on the radar now is just kind of really preparing us for growth. I don't, if us being, you know, a big, huge, huge company means that I lose my sovereignty, or that I have a phone attached to my ear 24/7, or all of a sudden I don't have more time than I need, then I'm not interested. And so, you know, to date, like, it's probably one of the reasons I never got any investors. I don't want to go do business with anyone that doesn't feel like good business just because somebody else is worried about their return.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because when you go into in the business world in general, right, everybody thinks you have to work 100 hours and you got to go crazy and you got to kill yourself and all this stuff. And you can't really be true to who you are, what your real vision is, right? Because you don't want to offend somebody. You don't want them to not understand it. It's actually the exact opposite for you, right? You understood who you are, who you wanted to be, what the company's goal was, what it kind of come back to that word alignment. it didn't prohibit you from being successful in this space. It probably made you more successful. How do people overcome that fear of saying, I have to kind of go by society standards and instead define what works for them? And you've seen it with people like the Tim Ferrisses of the world with the 4-hour works weeks, people like yourself. You've been able to garner great success by kind of creating your own rules.
Yeah, we made our own genre.
You know what? But people,
despite ourselves.
But people adopt it.
Yeah.
Why? You know, and that's the thing, is so many people I feel like are afraid to create their own rules and set their own standards because it's so abnormal. Yeah. Or like, we take it back. You talk about, are people genius because it was simple, or simply are they geniuses? Yeah.
Well, so it's funny. So like, if you look at kind of what the world calls a rock star, right? And that word gets thrown around a ton, but like, a couple things I think about rock stars. So first of all, nobody in the history of rock and roll or greatness ever played it safe. So if look, and we're all wired differently, like seriously, our minds from a neuroscience perspective of like, hey, everybody doesn't have, like my wife, she doesn't have the same tolerance for risk that I do, right? So, you know, if you want to be an entrepreneur and you're really risk averse, and you don't have thick skin, probably not the path for you, man. Go get the 9-to-5 and be happy and make sure you're doing something that you love. But rock stars don't really give a shit about what anyone thinks. Doesn't mean they don't care about people.
That's important.
You know, I got asked to do a national anthem years ago at a NASCAR race. It was going to be on ESPN, all this. It was terrifying. It's why I did it, because it scared the hell out of me. And I remember going on YouTube and trying to find all these videos, and I'm watching Marvin Gaye and Whitney Houston and all these, you know, all these people doing this stuff. And it was freaking me out. And finally I went, you know what, screw it. I'm going to do it the way Alan Schaefer does it. And that's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to focus on that. And it was really liberating. And the thing is, we're all artists. And what we lose sight of is that, you know, a precious stone, like a rare diamond, it's valuable because it's rare, because it's one of a kind. Every single one of us is a one of a kind artist with a unique voice. There's nobody else in the world that's going to have your point of view. There's no one else in the world that's going to have my exact point of view. My suggestion is, don't be afraid of it. That has more value than you might be given credit for. And that's taken me a while.
Yeah.
You know? It's taken me a while to get to that place.
I'll tell you, I feel like a broken record because I keep on saying this with everybody that keeps on coming on the podcast. But what you just said is literally the commonality amongst the creatives, the entrepreneurs, the innovators, the risk takers. You said, I did it because it scared me.
Yeah.
Every single person says, do what makes you scared. It's kind of like common, like it's the consistent theme. Yeah. So it's cool to kind of see people like yourself that haven't heard some of these previous ones or just kind of come in. But yet there's certain things that people in this world possess that you hear the terms, the thought process, and you go, okay. So I'm hoping that people that may look at these things and think they're not a big deal, or listening to the podcast and go, I did it because it scared me. I thought that was cool. There may be something greater there for you than just thinking it's cool. Yeah. It may lead to a greater opportunity because you're not afraid to risk it. You're not afraid to give it a shot. And you're going to be successful because if you're not looking at failure as failure, and if fear is not fear, but more of something that gets you excited, it says a lot about you as a character.
Well, that's kind of, and you know, it's interesting. Also, you know, it's one of the questions that I ask people in organizations. So how do you guys treat failure? And the way you answer that question determines, and in the words that one chooses, determines whether I believe or not we should be working together.
Wow. So words are your everything.
Words matter. Words matter. Think about all the times that you have a conversation with, whether it's a spouse, a friend, a coworker, and they're like, man, I can't believe you said that, or whether, well, I didn't mean that. Man, that's exactly what you said. What else am I supposed to go for? Like, that's the evidence. That's the data. And I call my mother out on this stuff. Well, you know, I didn't, you know, mom, the doctor said you're not supposed to have, you know, Coca-Cola's while you're in remission, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, well, I didn't mean that I was going to have a Coca-Cola, but you said it. And I believe you did mean it. So I'm calling bullshit. You know, whatever it is.
I'll tell you, I need to work on this because this would get me out of so many arguments with my wife. If I said, I always say the same thing. I say things that I just speak sometimes to speak. And then she goes, but then why'd you say it?
Yeah.
Well, it's not what I meant to say. I was trying to now that you said it though, like this, I'm going to check myself more and really think, is it what I'm intended to say?
Yeah. The key is though, you also want to make sure that you're not self-editing. So the condition, creating the conditions where you should be able to, anybody that really cares about you, you should be able to say just about anything as long as it's honest. Right. My wife and I, this morning, we had a thing because she asked me something and I gave her, I was in like work mode and hurry mode. And I gave her this like BS, really off-putting kind of Heisman stiff arm answer. And then we had this big conversation around it and she wasn't happy about it. But what's cool is we had this conversation and we realized we were able to dissect together why it happened, what the motivation was. Turned out that it was a little bit of a touchy subject for me. So I reacted based on previous stories in my head. So so now we have a hack for it. Next time she we're talking about something that's a touchy subject, instead of me bringing the baggage to it or her bringing the baggage, you want to know what the hack is that we came up with?
I'd love to know.
Okay, I'm about to share something. Put the gun down.
Okay.
I know that sounds crazy.
Okay.
Because basically she said something and I just went, and I started firing because I was defensive, you know, and I was wrong. And so, you know, so that's the whole thing for us, for the work that we do and for even what I do in my own life and with my wife, like it's about continuous improvement. So like, man, let's dissect why we just had this misunderstanding so we don't have this misunderstanding again. And we can apply what we learned so we have fewer until we get to the next misunderstanding. And but it's a battle of attrition. So we come up with all these hacks. Like, I'll tell you one other hack. If I'm being an asshole, either one of us, we say the word belly button. You know why? Because it makes us laugh. The reason it makes us laugh is because one time we were at my brother's house and my niece was little. She was about to walk up to my dog Rocco's south end and she had her finger out like she was going to point at it, right? And we're like, whoa, 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 what's going on? And Gina, her mom says, oh yeah, she thinks that anything that that's at face level is a belly button. So we equated belly button with asshole. So like all I have to do to
diffuses
say
the situation.
All I have to do to say to my wife or my wife that says to me, no matter how things get ahead, it's like belly button. And it's like this instant brain hack that makes us laugh and go, okay, let's reset.
Nice.
Yeah, it's all about the behavior hacks.
So let me ask you, well, we've talked about a lot over this past hour, which is awesome, man. You dropped a lot of insight. Like there's so many one-liners, man. I'm going to go back and listen to and start to utilize.
Okay, great.
So did you ever think when you look back at it, right, from 6 years old playing instruments to doing the things with the online web and seeing some of those trends to what you are doing now and how it infuses music with some of the behavioral elements that you learned at an early point, did you see yourself getting here? Was this what you kind of envisioned in the trajectory, that this all was kind of what you grew to put you in this moment that you're here now?
Hell no. And what I will say is this was never probable, but clearly it was possible.
See, I'm going to have to listen to this episode a lot.
Oh!
So, man, listen, appreciate you coming on today.
Oh, man, honored.
I want to leave everybody, if there's one thing that you can kind of leave everybody with that they take away from this episode, entrepreneurs, innovators, people going through challenges right now, what would you tell them?
Inventory your get-tos and your have-tos personally and professionally, and eliminate as many of the have-tos as you can. Might take some courage on a few of them. You might have to cut out a few people. You might even have to make a career change. But this is a marathon, not a sprint.
Love it, man. Love it. Well, listen, appreciate you coming on today.
I'm so honored.
This is a long time overdue. I know we have our talks all the time.
I love it.
So it's great to put it on to some official platform. So
yeah, and I love to hear from anybody. I'm here to help amplify anybody and everybody we can.
So shout out. How can people get in touch with you? Website, all that good stuff.
So the website is bandingpeopletogether.com or bandingpt.com. I'm on LinkedIn. Email me, Alan, A-L-A-N, at bandingpt.com, and I answer every email, I promise. And I love hearing from people, and I love learning.
Amazing, man. Well, thank you for the time today, and here's to a great year.
All right, back at you, man.
Thanks, man.
Once again, I'm your host, Justin Epstein, and thank you for listening to Culturation. As always, this show has been powered by Premiere.